I don't believe that venture is a highly scalable thing to do. I think if you want sort of like mediocre returns, maybe it is. What we see time and time again in the Valley or with new products and especially new CEOs is they'll try to market a product and they're like, feature, 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 feature. And you can, no one can win a feature war. You have to be really delivering something to the consumer. It can be a business, it can be a person, whoever's buying your product. I think things are always for sale. That's what I tell people. Everything has a price. Everything is always for sale, right? And things sell a lot better if there's not a for sale sign on them, right? More people will want them.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to FinTech Leaders, coming to you from New York City. I'm your host, Miguel Armaza, and I'm a co-founder of Gilgamesh Ventures, a venture capital fund that backs early-stage fintech entrepreneurs in the U.S., Canada, and Latin America. If you enjoyed this conversation, I invite you to leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your shows so more people can learn about FinTech Leaders. Today, I sit down with Rebecca Lin, co-founder and general partner at Canvas Ventures, an early stage VC with almost 900 million AUM focused on Series A's and B's in fintech, digital health, marketplaces, and logistics. Rebecca has been operating or investing in fintech for over 25 years and has also been ranked on the Forbes Midas list 5 years in a row. In this episode, we discuss marketing and data-driven go-to-market strategies from her experience at Next.com, how companies should think about preparing for M&A opportunities, the areas of fintech where AI is making an actual difference, challenges of building a VC fund from scratch, and a lot more. Rebecca, welcome to FinTech Leaders. Where are you joining us from today?
I am here in our office in Portola Valley, California.
Amazing, amazing. And I see all the nice logos of the many, many companies you have invested in. At this point, do you know the exact number of the companies you've invested in or close to?
No. I mean, it's been since, 2008. I probably have done 20 plus companies, I would say. I do a couple a year. So usually, 1 to 3 a year. So probably 20, 25 companies at this point in time. Me personally, I mean, the fund has done a lot more than that, me personally.
And so we're going to hear about your background, but I'm curious, you've been investing in VC for over 16 years. What were the toughest moments of those 16 years?
Oh, wow. The toughest moments. I mean, the toughest moments are always when things aren't going the right way for the companies. And it's always hard. I mean, it's a founder puts their heart and soul into a company and you really want to help them along. And I actually entered venture in 08, 09. And those were by far, we haven't seen years like that yet, where I entered and the firm, Morgan Thaler, the first one I worked with, handed me a couple companies to try to help save. And it was hard. I mean, there was no financing. We saw probably a dozen angel term sheets get pulled in the time span of a week and a half, where those companies then came to us, the Series A and B investors, trying to sort things out. And so term sheets were getting pulled. Investment rounds weren't getting done. Banks were calling capital. And it was a really hard time period. And then also companies that were relying on startups to pay them for receivables weren't able to collect. And so even companies that were doing relatively well were built on this sort of foundation of other startups. And so we saw a lot of companies not make it. And so that for me was really informative of just what to look for and what can go wrong and how to kind of help companies make sure that if things go south, they can get through it.
It sounds like you built a muscle that only happens with experience, but you did it very early on. Right at the beginning.
Yeah, well, and I also lived through the first .com too. So I was at a company called NextCard, which if people were around during that time, they definitely knew it. We were by far the largest online advertiser in terms of impressions out there. The only people who came close to our volume were Yahoo and Microsoft at the time, were really big online. And so that company went public and then got delisted after probably a year or so later. And so I saw sort of 30 to 1300 people, the IPO and the complete like life cycle of that company and all the companies around it too. We had 3000 people we worked with that we advertised on their sites. And so I was sort of front and center there from an operator perspective and then seeing sort of the next downturn really from the lens of a venture capitalist and also seeing the massive rise up on both sides. So seeing the explosion of technology and catching that ride a couple of different times and then seeing, you know, the cycles as they play out. So that's been super informative, both from an operator and as an investor.
Speaking of NextCard, you were one of the largest advertisers and you yourself, you were leading marketing there. So you were a tip of the spear. Maybe tell us a bit about what you learned during those years.
One thing I learned was never assume your competitors actually are competent and know what they're doing. We ran our marketing engine by the numbers and by the book. I mean, I came from Procter & Gamble. I was a chemical engineer in my old life. And so big companies, especially the P&Gs or the Kaplan's or the Cokes or the Amex's of the world, if you run a marketing test, you better be able to understand the confidence interval, the base size and all of that kind of stuff. And so, and if it's significant or not, but you better understand when you run a marketing test, if your results are significant or directional and really how to think about the variables that are in it and what's controlled, what's not controlled. And so we ran a pretty tight ship at NextCard. I mean, we could tell you to the thousandth of a penny what every dollar we brought in the door cost us by the minute, by the site that it came from, by the banner, by the splash page that it hit. I mean, we had that really dialed in. And it allowed us to optimize our marketing in a way and really get our average cost per account down. And so post-crash, we were acquiring credit card customers for an average CPA of like $32 in channels. And so that was sort of unheard of. It's still unheard of today, but we were able to do it because we had just control and had really engineered the entire front to back marketing engine to where we knew what we were getting and what we were paying. And what has surprised me is when I left NextCard, I thought, well, everyone else, all the competitors have had to have done that same thing. And I was amazed at how many didn't really have a good handle on their marketing numbers. I had one person come back. There was a guy that worked for me. He was really good. He was a director level person. He had gone to work for another fintech company. And after about a month, he calls me and he's like, hey, he goes, can I come back? And I said, of course. We were really sad he left. And then he tells me a story about how when he first started at this other fintech, which shall remain nameless, he kept thinking that maybe he kept asking about the marketing database. Where's the marketing database? He wanted to run his reports because we had really, really detailed reporting. And they kind of looked at him funny. And he kept thinking that like he hadn't been there long enough. And maybe it was this highly confidential thing that they just wouldn't let him have access to. And then he finally realized they didn't have it. And that they were just running kind of by the seat of their pants and really had no idea how to tune anything or what to do. And so he came back, which was really interesting. But I did learn that. I learned you never assume too much. Have a healthy respect for your competitors, but never assume too much.
So speaking of marketing and go-to-market, that's probably a muscle that you focus on, just like making sure that your companies have it, the companies that you are backing. And that, call it science, that talent has evolved a lot over the last two decades. Maybe can you share how are you helping your companies apply those marketing lessons, those go-to-market muscles?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's really interesting what we learn very early in our career that we might take for granted, and how if you get a really good fundamental understanding and learning and get a really good education, how that investment pays off many years later. And so I was really lucky when I came out of my engineering school. I went to work at Procter & Gamble and then was tapped to be on the international new market entry team. So I did new markets, new products globally. and with consumers that were very different than me, right? And so I learned from probably the best company in the world how to understand what consumers are telling them, how to understand their preferences, how to really get product market fit in a way that's meaningful to the consumer, and how to message it. And so what we see time and time again in the Valley or with new products and especially new CEOs is they'll try to market a product and they're like, feature, 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 feature. And you can, no one can win a feature war. You have to be really delivering something to the consumer. It can be a business, it can be a person, whoever's buying your product. That is like a rung higher than that. Like, what is the true pain point they're solving? Because 9 times out of 10, people don't really care how you're doing it, right? They don't care. And most companies, that's all they want is help people, is how they're doing it. And it takes them a while to understand that all that is a reason to believe of how you're solving their problem or what pain point you're alleviating from them, right? And so it takes a while for a lot of people to understand that those two things have to be split and that you really have to go up the ladder a couple of rungs to help people help message and formulate the messaging for the company of what the pain point is that you're solving. And then, of course, talk about features or functionality or whatever, but it's not the first thing that you should be talking about. And that's not how you should position the product. And so that's what we help people with a lot. And it seems like it's not a one and done kind of thing. It evolves over time in a company as they evolve their product offering, as they expand the customers that they're serving and so forth. And so that it's really important to help them tune that and kind of get it right.
And let's talk about the distinction of B2C go-to-market versus B2B, because you have invested in both and you have great companies in your portfolio. They're also doing both, right? At the end of the day, they're both selling, but tell us about this distinction.
Yeah, I mean, there's B2B, right? So direct to a business and the business is going to use you. And more often it's B2B2C, right? So you were selling like a company like Airbet, for example, where the Airbet is selling to companies, so HR and benefits providers within a company. But then the end user is really the employee in the company that's using that service. And that's a great service. It's super fun. Do you have a dog, Miguel?
No.
No dogs, no cats? Oh my gosh. Okay. Well, if you did, you would definitely want to use Airbet because it's telemedicine for pets. And so if you have a dog or cat or whatever.
I'll tell my brother.
Yeah, tell him about it and see what he says. It's a great app to use. I've used it many times in the middle of the night. But in that case, in the B2B2C part of it, you actually have two hoops you have to jump through, right? So with B2C, the main thing is you don't want to have to acquire or reacquire that customer every single time. So one of the companies that we're in that's B2C is Possible Finance, and they're doing great. And the reason they're doing so well is because they've really, again, listened to the consumer. And this is sort of, I call it deep subprime or really no prime credit pocket. They have done a very good job of truly servicing that customer. And because of that, their NPS score is off the charts. And they have a really good organic following as well. And by the way, on their marketing efforts on TikTok and Meta and the like, they have really good content that they can talk about because they're really solving a key customer pain point and they understand that quite well. So that with Possible, that's a good example of just direct B2C marketing, right? And then that customer stays with them on their journey. They don't churn every single time and have to then go reacquire the customer. They've built really a lifetime value prop for that individual. And then a company that is really more B2B is Casetext, right? So Casetext is a company, I don't know if you had read about the company or not, but they were recently acquired by Thomson Reuters. And they're very, very deep AI, arguably one of the most robust implementations of GPT-4 still to date. And Casetext sold to enterprises. And so again, you know, when you sell to an enterprise, you have a first sale, but then you have a second sale, right? You have to get people using that product internally. So you really are serving two clients in many ways. And then similarly for B2B2C, kind of the golden rule there is that you really need to make sure that if you're selling to like an HR organization within a company, that you have access to actually market to those end users. And that's a key kind of rule overall. I used to do co-brands when I was at Nextcard. And if you inked a deal where you were going to do a co-branded credit card, but then couldn't market to acquire that end user, it was really challenging and often fatal, right? For that relationship. And so when you're doing a B2B2C motion where you have sort of a second sale, you really have to make sure upfront in that first sales call that you have buy-in to sell to that end user and that they're supportive and that there's some skin in the game where you're going to have access to market to that person.
So speaking of acquisitions, more than a few of your companies have been acquired. And we are now at a point in the cycle where we're probably expecting to see more M&A activity, right, in the coming months. I'd love to get your read on the market, but more importantly, how can a company better prepare for that outcome, for an M&A opportunity?
I think this is a great question. And I think there are many ways a company can better prepare for that outcome. I think things are always for sale. That's what I tell people. Everything has a price. Everything is always for sale, right? And things sell a lot better if there's not a for sale sign on them, right? More people will want them. And so what I tell my CEOs pretty early on, probably post Series B, is that there should be a certain amount of time in their calendar every week where they're reaching out externally to potential partners, people in the space. They're just getting their name out there. They're getting to know people, right? And I think it's really easy as a CEO to just sort of be heads down, focused internally at your own business with your own investors and your own customers. But it's really important. And Casetext did this incredibly well. Gabby did this really well also. Gabby was bought by Experian, where the CEO spent a lot of time cultivating those relationships, building trust over time. And the best way to do it is to have some kind of business partnership or relationship where you're already working together. There's some definite, I hate the word synergies, but we'll use it. There's definite sort of synergies to the business. There's a mutual respect. There's a trust. There's an understanding. And if you do that early, it takes a while. It's not like you have the conversation and the next month they're like, oh, we want to buy you, right? It really has to happen over time. And the best acquisitions are ones where they're built over time. There's some kind of business relationship that's been established. It doesn't have to be a really deep one. It doesn't be a full integration, but there has to be some kind of relationship. And then they end up kind of evolving. The other thing that I tell people, and it's funny, I always get pushed back on the board from this. I say, well, hire a banker, and everyone rolls their eyes. And you were in banking, right? Like everyone's like, oh, we don't want to hire a banker. But the problem is they're thinking of the wrong banker, right? They're thinking of one of these big banks, the Goldman's or the Citi's or whatever. And when I say that, that's not what I mean at all. What I mean is more of a very boutique banker who knows that space incredibly well and who will come on board with you and help you with these sort of BD relationships for, you know, a period of time, sometimes well over a year, right? And help you think through that process, make the right introductions at the right time. And if you get the right person, it's almost like you have a free corp dev person, right? Because your interests are fully aligned. They want to sell the company for a lot of money and you want them to sell the company for a lot of money. And so if you do it right, it's really great. And we had a nice experience with, for example, with Oppenheimer, with Gabby. They actually manufactured the entire relationship with Experian over time. And Gabby had already had several kind of inbound offers that the company had considered, but then declined. And then after working with Oppenheimer for a fair bit, I mean, they introduced them to Experian and a couple other deals. And then Experian ended up buying the company. And they helped through that whole process, which was a very, very deep diligence process. So they were helpful there. So two things really on the sale, like focus externally earlier than you think. And you know, I've set up suggested rules of thumb for my CEO saying, okay, at least one, if not two meetings on your calendar every single week with somebody else in your industry. And the other thing that sometimes happens is people think, oh, well, they're competitive, right? And they don't want to talk to them. Well, you can meet with people and tell them whatever you want to tell them, right? But so you don't have to go meet with somebody and give them the keys to the kingdom, right? But definitely go have a relationship. You're going to learn a lot. And so I think people hesitate to reach out and have meetings with other competitors or people they think might be competitive, but you should have those earlier than you think. And you shouldn't be afraid to reach out to those people.
Rebecca, staying on this point, which is, I think is very interesting. There is this narrative right now in our industry that M&A is done, at least for the time being. Do you think people are extrapolating from just a few big examples, or is M&A really on pause?
I don't think M&A is ever truly on pause, right? I don't think, I mean, in our industry, it's so cyclical. I mean, twice now, venture capital has been dead, right? Those headlines have come out. It sort of is an every 10-year thing. I think M&A, the same thing kind of happens. I don't think M&A is on pause at all. I think Casetext was bought very quickly with an inbound offer from Thomson Reuters. That was not a manufactured exit in any way. So it was all cash. I mean, it was a very clean offer, right? And so if you're building something of value, that especially something that a company can't live without, when they see their entire business model potentially be disrupted by advances in AI, for example, they have cash on the balance sheet. There's no systemic reason why M&A should be on pause. I think part of the challenge is a lot of these companies are burning so much cash that they're not good acquisition targets. And so I think that is a challenge with many of these companies, that they're big companies, no matter how big, don't want to acquire an asset that's a net negative on their income statements.
Going back to the beginning of our conversation, you mentioned that we have not seen something akin to 2008. And of course, that was the great global financial crisis. How do you compare 2008 versus what we've lived over the last, call it 2 years, since mid-2022 to today?
What we've lived today is a much more soft landing. I mean, 2008 was definitely just a light switch hit, right? And term sheets were pulled. People reset very quickly. Everyone went into protection mode of their current portfolio. So we didn't see new deals really get done. We're seeing a lot of that same behavior, but it's not so black and white. It's not so draconian, right? We're seeing a lot of big firms, like especially later stage funds, even use the words like too big to fail, right? So they've put so much money in these startups that, again, are still burning a lot of cash, that they then will come in and protect with their own capital, right? So we're seeing these inside, very similar to 2008, we're seeing a lot of those inside rounds get done. We're seeing companies try to really cut their burn rate and stretch out their capital. We're seeing a lot of that similar kind of behavior. But at the same time, we're also seeing this new technology wave of AI and what kind of promise that brings to the table also. So we have some brilliant, exciting things to invest into. I think the similarity of the 2008 time period was really the iPhone, right? So for those who don't remember, before that, mobile was really a walled garden. There were a lot of things people thought, oh, I would love to be able to do that thing on my mobile phone, but it was almost impossible. You had to go cut deals with carriers. And then when iPhone came out, it created a lot of opportunity for new companies to be built, much like AI is doing today, right? So it's very similar. Or similar situation in terms of a big tech trend kind of coming into that ecosystem.
Yeah, and like I think you're giving us a hint to the answer to my next question, but it's more about the sectors that you are bullish on, and then sounds like you're paying a lot of attention to the new developments of AI, but maybe expand a little bit on that and maybe tell us if there are other sectors within fintech that you're excited about.
Yeah, there are a lot of fintech sectors I'm really interested in. And so in terms of just AI in general, we've been in sort of the AI and the LM space for well over a decade. I was at Morgan Thaler and we were the first investors in Siri, for example. So we've followed the whole sort of migration from Siri to kind of where we are today. And the evolution of AI has just been spectacular to watch. And just to kind of put a point on what AI has delivered, when Casetext tried to pass the bar a year ago in March of 2022, they could only get the algorithms to score about 30-ish%, right? And then that was with GPT 3.5. They got very early access to GPT 4. They got it, I think, in July of 2022. And when that happened, the CEO called an emergency board meeting and on a weekend and said, I know I just told you I had a whole product roadmap. I'm ditching that entire roadmap and everything is going to be focused on this new technology. And we all took a deep breath and we trusted Jake and we said, okay. And then in January of 2023, he had the demo and he showed it to us again on a weekend. And it was mind-blowing in terms of what he could actually do. And in 1 year, they went from like a 30% kind of score on the bar to 94%. They could do better than the average bar pass rate of like 69%. So not as good as a human, too far superior than a human in the course of 12 months, right, is what they were able to deliver. So that same advancement we expect to apply in fintech and other verticals, right? In fintech, we really like compliance still. We're looking heavily at compliance. We've looked at compliance for many years. Banks and institutions spend a huge amount of money on fraud, compliance, and the like. And we think that what's here with AI now can really help replace a lot of those heavy labor costs. And then we really like areas like wealth management, for example. Much of the sort of back office kind of work that wealth managers are having to do today can really be lifted with the help of what the advances in AI today.
Yeah, I'm certainly excited about it as well. I mean, there's so many verticals where this is being applied. It's very hard to keep track, honestly. Going back to your transition from investor to founder and then manager, why even decide to start Canvas? Take us back to 11 years ago.
So I was really fortunate when I started out to have a team of people that spent a lot of time training me. I think that was really a terrific experience. A lot of VCs aren't lucky enough to have that happen, right? And so I looked at a lot of companies, and then Lending Club was the first deal that I led. And interestingly, with that company, when we gave Renaud the term sheet, and I know Renaud's an investor in your fund, right? He's a great, great individual and many time founder, actually. He had said that he would sign it, but only if I was the board member because he wanted my help on the go-to-market, right? And marketing. And so my partners at Morgan Thaler at the time said, of course, they were very supportive. And so I took that role on. And then that company at Lending Club ended up being the largest US tech IPO in 2014. So sometimes things happen that are very lucky. It more than returned our fund. Doximity then returned it a few more times. And so when we went out to really figure out what we wanted to do with this next fund, right, that was Morgan Thaler Fund 9 that we were investing in, we took a look at it and we said, well, we have an opportunity right now to create the kind of firm and fund that we would want to have as an entrepreneur. And it was a time in the market when there weren't a lot of funds started. Very few, right? We had a lot of LPs say, oh gosh, how are you going to do this? How are you going to recreate this brand? But the question in my mind was really a question I dealt with when I was at Procter & Gamble, which is, do you sort of reposition an existing brand or do you create a new brand? And most times it is a better strategy to create a whole new brand than trying to reposition a former brand. And with Morgan Thaler too, they had a phenomenal history. They had a great reputation. However, you couldn't spell it, which is sort of rule one when you pick a name, that the name the spelling was slightly different than most people would have guessed. And then the other thing is I really wanted to create something that would endure. And I think it's fundamentally hard to do that when somebody else's name is on the door. So when I hire partners, I want them to really feel ownership, right? And I think it's hard to do that when the firm carries somebody else's name. So if you give them a name that everyone can kind of own and everyone can create their own canvas, right? Then you create something that can endure past you.
What's the most challenging part of building a fund for you?
I think the most challenging part is fundraising because the LPs want to come in at probably the worst time to invest. And they pull back when you're like, now's the time, right? So right now really feels like kind of that 08, 09 time period. And by the way, those funds were amazing funds, right? And you see the possibility because there's not so much capital flowing around, right? You can take your time. You can pick the right company. There is a huge opportunity. But then LPs get nervous now when I think they should be leaning in. And the really good LPs know this, right? But that's the most challenging, is that because venture is sort of this leading and lagging indicator in some ways, right? It gets off cycle to where when the LPs want to come in. And so you see all these numbers get put up on the board, and then the LPs are like, oh, they want to flood in, but it's exactly the wrong time to do it, right? The right time is when there's a correction. That's when they should really be leaning in, I think. So that's the biggest challenge, I think.
Yeah, I'm smiling because I have a lot of empathy. And how about training? You said you had really good mentors when you started. What's your approach to training young talent in venture?
I really shifted over the last few years to more of a training kind of focus. I think for many years, I thought, what do I have to teach anyone? Like, this is just sort of second nature and I don't know anything special. And then I've been listening, right? And I've come to appreciate that I do have a lot that I can train other people with. And really we've leaned into just this ecosystem of people, mostly like at Berkeley, for example. We just brought on an associate from Berkeley who's absolutely terrific. And just having them sort of like glued to us, it's really an apprenticeship model. I think venture has always been an apprenticeship model. It's you learn by doing, right? And learn by observing and having people with you too when things aren't working out. That's really, I think, the most important thing. Just have people really early in their career see how you help companies navigate through those bumps in the road, that it's not all up and to the right. And so I especially try to bring our more junior people along with me when we're having those kind of conversations, or we have a lot of strategy sessions around challenges that might pop up in go-to-market or in a new product development or something like that. And so I think having those young people really close to you is important. I don't believe that venture is a highly scalable thing to do. I think if you want sort of like mediocre returns, maybe it is. But I think venture is really, it's a knowledge base and it's not incredibly scalable. And so I really like to have people that have been operators in the past and have seen good times and bad, and really have this scent, have sort of the core skill set of go to market and helping people with that. And then I really like to hire people who are just connectors. I think that is really what 90% of our job is to go in, figure out what the problem is that people are, the company is having or experiencing, or the challenge, or if they want to grow, what's the growth strategy? But you have to really look at the company. You have to know what the skill sets of everyone who are there really is, right? And then the solution is not us telling the founder what to do. It's helping that founder find the right person that will go solve that problem better than we can, or the founder can, or anyone else on the team, right? And so it's really this, like, that skill set of being a connector and then thinking, oh, wow, when I was at this company or when I was at Berkeley 3 years ago, there was a person there and they know this special thing, right? Or they know how to do this kind of thing. And then also culturally, I think the cultural fit is so important and so overlooked that three or four people can do that job on paper. But who is going to come in and culturally be successful at that company with that team at that time? I think that's really important too.
Yeah. And on the connector front, what I've really observed is you have to be able to connect founders or someone in the team to the right person at the right time.
At the right time with the right introduction. And sometimes I've learned too, I don't just throw things over the wall anymore. Oftentimes I will make sure that I get on the phone and introduce them both and make sure that the conversation kind of goes in a very constructive way where they understand why they've been introduced.
And so, Rebecca, I've actually met a few of the founders you have backed, and they're different people, right? Different personalities. But of course, I'm sure that you can tell me that they have things in common. When it comes to qualities of some of the most successful entrepreneurs you've worked with, what are some of those qualities that are maybe not discussed enough?
I think the successful entrepreneurs really have, they have kind of one unifying characteristic, and that's grit. It really, truly is grit. And it's not a function of where they went to school or really what they even studied, but it's where did you come from and how did you get here, right? And tell me about that journey, because if the answer is, oh, I went to a prep school on the East Coast and I got straight A's, and then I went to Stanford and I got straight A's, and then I did this YC thing, and like, okay, no, right? But if instead it's, I mean, I love Jake's, I mean, Jake's story is phenomenal, right? I mean, Jake went to the GSB, which we won't hold against him. I'm from Berkeley, so go Bears. But anyway, so Jake went to the GSB for law school and he went to Pitzer for undergrad. However, neither his parents went to college, and his dad didn't even graduate from high school. And so you get his story of like growing up in the Santa Cruz Mountains and sort of like his whole experience. And it's just, and he takes nothing for granted, right? He's a super hard worker. He's a very thoughtful human being. And he just, I think people that have that experience and they come from a very different background and they're here, they couldn't just take assumptions at face value, right? They kind of had to question everything along the way and also believe that anything was possible. And so those people too are who are going, you know, when things go south, and CaseText, for example, wasn't always up and to the right. Neither, I don't think any of my companies were always up and to the right. And the question is, well, when that happens, how are they going to tackle the problem? Are they just going to, you know, address it in stride and be like, oh, of course, you know, this, you know, there's a problem. And they don't lose their cool about it, right? They really set about to, how are we going to overcome it? How are we going to fix it? And how are we going to be better kind of on the other side of it? And so I think the word, again, the word grit is probably really overused and pretty pretty cliche maybe, but I think that is the key thing, right? That really truly successful founders have is that.
Yeah, that distance travel is key, right? And it can be immigrants. It can be people from the same country that, like you said, overcame all sorts of crazy situations.
Ask Renaud sometime about baking bread in the morning before school at his dad's bakery, right, in France.
I will. I'm sure. Rebecca, before I let you go, are there any books that you find yourself recommending often?
I'm just laughing because I don't have time to read books. that was on your list of questions. And I'm like, oh my gosh, as a mom of three and like all this crazy stuff, I only wish I had tons of time to read. I will say that one that I enjoyed reading a lot most recently was, I like historical fiction. If I do have a time to read, I like historical fiction quite a bit. And I like biographies of people, especially like we're talking about people who kind of came from like such a different background and like kind of rose to the top. And so John Mack, and I go way back, he was on the board of Lending Club with us very early on. He's an investor in our fund. And I just had the chance to read his autobiography. And it was great. It was just really very interesting to hear about this person that I've known over the years and just kind of where he came from and his background and kind of how he thought about the world. So I really enjoyed it. I thought it was great.
Amazing. We'll have to provide the link. Well, Rebecca, thanks for doing this. Really interesting stuff. I think your journey is quite fascinating. You've done a lot, but I feel that we're going to see a lot more coming from you, from Canvas. So thanks for taking the time.
Yeah, thank you for hosting us on the podcast. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for tuning in. I hope you enjoyed this great episode with Rebecca Lynn from Canvas Ventures. If you want more interviews, make sure to subscribe, follow, and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your shows. It helps and truly, truly means a lot. And if you have any suggestions or thoughts about the show, just drop me a line on Twitter or LinkedIn. Signing off till next week, I'm your host, Miguel Armaza.